Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, definitely the yin and yang outfit.
It is, isn't it?
Right? So like, yeah. I grow my own stuff and I can put it up in my home kitchen for my family. And then Fair Oaks Dairy milks 32,000 cows three times a day. It's a co-op of sorts, but not quite, but like 10 different farms, 5 different families.
Yep.
Agritourism as well.
And I've been to both. I've been to your kitchen.
Yeah, you have.
And I've been to Fair Oaks. We stopped on the way home to my high school reunion. And it was a fascinating visit, primarily because they have a calving barn with huge windows and public's invited in to watch calves being born, which is part of the process.
Sure.
No calves, no pregnant moms, no milk.
No milk, right.
So that's the way it works. But it was, I just love to watch the kids' faces. I thought they might be squeamish. The adults were squeamish. The kids were fascinated.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah. So it's cool.
So yeah, I think some people think, oh, you know, it's that huge industrial agricultural model. But at the same time, they're allowing a glimpse of what it takes to actually run a production like this. And at least these 5 farm families are really making a successful go at it. So, you know, there's a happy balance in there somewhere. There's got to be, you know.
And I think we also have to mention up front, this will be our last regular show, I think, our last weekly regular show. We're all unhappy about it. The station is, we're unhappy about it, but it's budget constraints. And even now we're seeking sponsors to maybe keep this thing going.
We're hoping that we'll be able to bring Homegrown to you on a seasonal basis, kind of special basis.
Or more,
exactly. Yeah. And, you know, hopefully resurrect it as well. But for now, with the economy and, you know, it's a very multifaceted sort of complicated issue for the station. But they were sort of forced to make some serious cuts. And unfortunately, that includes Homegrown for now. So but we're hoping that we'll be able to come back from time to time.
Yeah. Or more.
Yes. So
bottom line,
we're not giving up on it quite yet, but we won't be on regularly.
Bottom line, we love doing the show.
We really do.
We love public radio.
We do.
We hope it will continue, but
don't be too mad at people.
No. Or help us out.
Yeah, exactly.
we want to come back, believe me.
Yeah, we do want to come back, and I know that they want us to come back. They didn't want to have to do this, so we'll try to work through it together, All
and
right.
Speaking of home stuff, what's up with the Wishy Garden?
Asian pears and apples. I will send, when we go do our home canning, I will send some Asian pears and some apples home with you.
Good deal.
They're beautiful this year. The Asian pears are, you know, and we don't use chemicals.
Yeah.
Somehow, some way, most of the apples are pretty darn clean.
Yeah.
And the Asian pear is almost always clean. Last year, I don't know if you remember, the raccoons got everything overnight, literally one fell swoop overnight. I was going to harvest the next day, go back, and they're all gone. So this year, I'm not going to make the same mistake. I'm going to harvest, you know, as they ripen up. So I'll send some home with you. They're just delicious. And the Asian pear is a tree that Bob and I often recommend for backyard orchard. You know, get a couple trees, and you'll really be able to enjoy some great fruit in late summer. It stores really well, so you've got some good shelf life, and it's very low maintenance. So so give it a try. How about you, Bob?
Well, actually, this is from the Wishy Estate also. You know, you've got that wonderful meadow there, and I've been reluctant to try because it's such a process. So I decided this past weekend I'm going to have a meadow walk. I got a 3-acre pasture back there. I'm going to cut a path, and I'm going to create like 10 or 12 little spots where I can begin my meadow plants, my native plants.
Okay.
So you can walk the meadow, and you can stop, and I'll have signs of what they are.
Okay.
Go to the next one, the next one. I've got a shady, wet area. I've got a full sun area. I've got a morning sun, afternoon shade area. I'm going to fill them, each one, full of native plants and just walk around.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a cop-out.
I don't think so either, because you make it kind of interesting and Bob Hill-esque. Well, and similarly, we got this email from a listener, and it was awesome. He took his backyard, and he's planting like a couple foot strip. Instead of like having a perennial garden edging your backyard, he's going to plant a prairie against the fence in his backyard. So it's going to be all bordered by this like little mini prairie border. Is that not awesome?
I like that.
I like it too.
And
I
I'm
think
doing
it's
going
to look awesome.
Yeah, I'm going to have a 3-acre meadow with little spots of the old natives.
Right.
And so people can walk around. We get all kinds of visitors anyway. People can walk around out there.
And then they'll get comfortable with what they look like and what they are. And that will help us get more prairie plants in backyards.
And who knows, I may extend this until I got 3 acres of prairie.
Yeah, exactly. There, in 10 years, it may all Hidden Hill may be a big old prairie.
Yeah,
right?
Speaking of which, cows like prairie.
Cows do like prairie.
Cows give milk.
They do.
And as I mentioned earlier, I was driving up through northern Indiana and bumped into this incredible place. It's Fair Oaks Farm in a man named Gary Corbett. He's the CEO. And Fair Oaks is a combine of northern Indiana farms that milks almost 32,000 cows a day. So Gary's with us today from Fair Oaks to talk about the operation and what it's like to milk that many cows while inviting in the public to watch. Gary, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yeah, well, I talked a little earlier with you before I went on the air, and you have a great background. You're an OBGYN, and you worked for Dean Foods, and now you're in the process of milking 32,000 cows a day. Kind of walk us down that little farm path if you can.
Well, you just got to get up early and start hard. Yeah, no, I spent a great deal of my career with Dean Foods in a lot of different capacities at the corporate level, and it was a great job. We've been around dairying all of our lives, and once I made a decision to retire from Dean's, this opportunity came along. The dairy farm families that are involved with Fair Oaks have been longtime acquaintances of mine, even when I was back with Dean Foods, and so they said, well, rather than sit around and do nothing, why don't you come and join us? And so I joined them 7-8 years ago, and as their CEO over a number of different businesses, and I've thoroughly enjoyed the opportunity.
So what is it exactly in terms of, not quite what it's become, but like how did it start out? Was it like a co-op of farm families?
Well,
or what?
I mean, there's two terms you use there, and you can use them interchangeably or not.
Uh-huh.
We are involved with some formalized cooperatives, both in the upper Midwest and down in the Southwest, that these farm families started over the years and that we continue to manage today, but that's a whole separate other business. These particular farm families that are involved with Fair Oaks,
okay,
we've just known each other a very long time, are involved in a lot of other businesses through the years, going back into the 80s, and so they've just had a familiarity with each other and a lot of business connections, and mm-hmm. and it's just continued over the last 25 or 30 years.
And were these farms, these dairies, actually in close proximity to one another, which allowed this Fair Oaks to sort of
everybody
evolve?
Started out in California,
uh-huh.
and then we moved to Southwest Texas and uh-huh. Huh. and New Mexico, mm-hmm. and from there, virtually everybody's moved up here. And so,
was it the same MO in all three places?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Back in the 90s, we started looking at things that and factors that were going to impact our ability to dairy in the 21st century. And so, as we looked at factors, we kind of came on 7 or 8 that we thought were going to have a lot of impact, and made strategies and decisions around those, and that kind of culminated us into moving up into the Midwest, and one of them is an outcropping with starting Fair Oaks Farms.
So what was desirable about northern Indiana?
You know, there's a lot of things that we took a look at. One, it's a great feed source. We like the pay price up here. The proximity to the fluid market, the class one market as we call it in the dairy industry, was very attractive up here, and it's just an area, and the state of Indiana was very hospitable to us.
Mm-hmm.
So there were just a number of factors that went into us deciding to come up here.
Let's deal with some numbers here. You milk, you said earlier today, 32,000 cows a day. You're farming 17,000 acres to keep them fed, and you're getting, I don't know how many gallons or pounds of milk a day.
You know, we own a little more acreage than that. We own about 25,000 acres,
okay.
And if you take 3,000 or 4,000 out that we use for conservation,
mm-hmm.
and layout strips and that type of thing, we farm a lot of ground. Yes, we produce about 2.8 million pounds of milk a day. That's 325,000 gallons. That's about 5.2 million 8 ounce glasses of milk.
Okay.
And so just to give people a relative basis of that, that would supply every man, woman, and child in the city of Chicago, the city of Indianapolis, and pretty much everybody in between. So it's a lot of milk.
Well, what is your market? Where does it go?
You know, most of our milk goes to the southeast. It heads your direction.
Uh-huh.
It'll go to Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Kentucky, Tennessee, you know, the Southeast tends to be a deficit market with regards to population versus milk production. And so our 55, 60 loads of milk off of Fair Oaks tends to head to the Southeast every day.
Wow.
So do these large, Gary, do you think that these large models, you know, it's working for you all, but does it make it continually more and more difficult? Obviously, these are one of the reasons why you all moved and collaborated and came up with this model. But is it going to continue to make it more difficult for that smaller dairy farmer to make it?
Not in our opinion. You know, I think a good operator, now, I mean, you're not going to milk 20 cows anymore, but
right,
can you milk 100 cows? Can you milk 80 cows and do a good job and be on top and be a good manager and still make a living and make a good living and enjoy your way of life? Absolutely, in our opinion. Mm-hmm.
So when you're a farmer, when you're a dairier like that, that's where those more traditional co-ops come into play, right? You pull
if
your
that's
milk.
Your desire, mm-hmm, you know, or you could just be a direct shipper or whatever, you know. I mean, that's a matter of choice on the individual farmer, but we certainly believe there's going to be a place for all size farms going forward. You know, we happen to pick a big model, but mm-hmm, history will have to say whether that was a good decision or a bad decision. But there'll be a place for everybody that's just a good operator.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's what's going to determine whether you're around over the next decade is if you're a good operator and not size so much.
So, okay. One of the most unusual things, really, about Fair Oaks is the fact that you welcome the public in to see from birth from birth to milking. And I think, like, one of the little quotes that you all have is your grass to glass.
Correct.
So why did you all find it important to sort of turn it into somewhat of an agritourism educational component?
That was a critical part. As we were back in the 90s and we looked forward, that was an aspect that, as we did our homework, that we thought was going to be really important. In the 90s, you started seeing the development of some of these groups that weren't necessarily enamored with animal agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, took opposition, whether it be the PETAs of the world or Humane Society or whomever it might be. And they just were against animal agriculture and continue to be that way today. These groups tend to be extremely articulate. They tend to be very well funded, and they're very passionate about what they believe. And so we tried to study that phenomena. But what got our attention about that was not so much these groups. I mean, they are who they are and whatever. But it's more that we were struck by the audience that they were talking to, and that's the population of the U.S. And that is the fact that a lot of people have become disconnected from agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Less than 2% of our population now makes its living from agriculture. You know, you go back into the 50s, there were probably 4.5-5 million dairy farms in the United States. Today, there's about 60,000-65,000. If you're of my generation, you probably either grew up on a farm or you had a grandpa or you had a cousin. You had somebody that when you were a kid, you could at least go out and see that not all food just did come from Kroger or whomever. And that was a concern to us, is because now we're 4 or 5 generations away mm-hmm. from that. So that there was a whole audience out there in the United States that
it's
is that they really
and
just
so
didn't
separate.
Have an
yeah.
understanding of what yeah. 21st century ag was all about. And so we made a decision that we wanted to be more proactive when it came to that role mm-hmm. and go on the offensive more than the defensive. And we made a decision in 2004 to invite the public onto our farm so that we could take the opportunity to, one, show them what a 21st century dairy farm looked like, and then, two, while they were here, hopefully try to educate them about dairying and agriculture in general. We have 3 primary messages that we try to impart to these folks, all of our visitors, and that is ag and agriculture and the environment are compatible, agriculture and animal welfare are compatible, and in our case, milk is good for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've structured our whole experience around those 3 messages. And so that was the driver, is to be able to allow people to see that there are farms out there every day and people working hard 7 days a week in the case of dairy to put food on the shelves. And we yeah. wanted them to see have an opportunity to see how that's done.
Yeah, to that end, Gary, give us a sense of the logistics of milking 32,000 cows a day. And you milk 3 times a day, which was one more than I did when I was a kid. So what was the three all about, and how do you do it?
You know, we milk on, we opened our first milking parlor in 1999. We came to Indiana in 98, and we opened the first one in 1999, and now we've added 9 sites. So we have 10 sites where we milk essentially 3,200 cows on each site within a very, in a relatively small radius of each other. None are too far apart from the others. And so, as you indicated, we do milk 3 times a day. We essentially milk 24 hours a day. We really milk about 22 and a half, and then an hour and a half for cleanup.
So what is a dairy cow going to do in a day? Does she get to go outside?
Well, they're all essentially housed in freestall barns that tend to be anywhere from a quarter to almost a half a mile long, so she has the opportunity to be in a freestall barn where she has free choice to walk around, pick the stall that she wants to to stay in or lay down in. Obviously, there's food in front of them 24 hours a day, as there is water. You know, a cow is a neat animal. You give her 100 pounds of feed and 30 gallons of water, and she'll give you 100 plus pounds of milk and 100 plus pounds of manure.
Yeah.
So, On Fair Oaks, we're a little unique in that we harvest both. And so obviously the milk is used for its purposes, but we collect 100% of the manure on all our farms and put it into anaerobic digesters. So we supply 100% of our own power.
Wow.
Plus we have so much extra that we then sell it onto the grid.
How long does each cow milk? How many years and such? And then, of course, go ahead.
These larger herds tend to turn over about a third every year.
Okay.
And so these cows are going to be anywhere from 5 to 8 years old.
And then they go off to canners and cutters, I guess. I mean,
that's correct.
It is meat. People don't think about that, but all these dairy cows don't end up on a happy farm. They become something else.
Yeah, whether they're on a large or small farm, it doesn't make any difference.
Exactly.
If they live long enough, that's going to be their eventual fate.
And you had talked about 17,000 acres that you all grow silage so that you can produce your own food. So does this mean that they're mostly grass-fed, hay, that sort of thing?
Well, we feed a corn silage-based ration, and so the majority of their ration will be corn silage, but then they'll get haylage, they'll get some dry hay, and then they get grain off of our along with that, and then any byproducts that our nutritionists think they should use.
It's because there's so much talk about milk without hormones in it.
Correct.
These days, do you all have to manage your herd with hormones or anything?
No, the big one in the industry is BST, and so none of our cows receive BST. A portion of our cows not only do not receive BST, they don't receive any hormones or antibiotics. So we split some of our cows up into what we call an all natural situation, but none receive any BST.
So Bob and I are fascinated with the whole calving room, and I watched. Bob was able to see it in person when he was there, and
he saw twins
being born, and he said the adults were probably a little more squeamish than the children, and the children were very fascinated with it, which was cool. And I watched like a YouTube thing when like the worst jobs or whatever came to visit you all. So it was wonderful to see. But that's a part of dairying that's critical if you want cows to produce milk.
Certainly.
So talk about the importance of having babies if you want to get milk.
Yeah, I mean, a cow will have its first calf roughly at the age of 2, and then she'll milk for approximately 10 months during that time, which will hopefully get her bred back, and then we'll dry her up for and let her rest for 2 months, and then she has another calf and starts the cycle. So it's extremely important that we're able to get these cows bred and them keep having a calf roughly every 12 months.
And do you do that artificially?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Yeah, I would imagine.
We have roughly, 110 to 120 calves a day born on the farm. As part of our experience, in 2005, we opened up the birthing center, where it's an amphitheater-type building where it seats about 350, 400 people in behind glass, much like in an aquarium. There's always 2 cows in the process of birthing or calving. and so people can sit there at their leisure and watch a calf be born. As you might imagine, it's a pretty over the top experience for most of our visitors. Probably 95% of our visitors have never been on a farm of any kind, and so to see a calf, especially a mammal that size, be born is a big deal for most people, and so it's a big part of our experience, and it's fascinating, you know, for us watching the calf be born is kind of old hat, but watching the reaction of people never is.
So did you ever, when you all started it, were some people like, oh, you shouldn't do that because it's...
No, we didn't. We really didn't get that kind of reaction. The reason we did start it is part of, as a part of our experience, we take people on a bus tour of one of our farms. Lasts roughly 50 to 60 minutes. And during that tour, we go into one area of our maternity barn. And so people were able to see potentially some cow in the process of having a calf, but the buses are on a schedule, and so they only sit there for X amount of time, sure. And then they go. And people were booing the driver and getting carried away because they wanted to see the final thing. And we thought, well, that's just a great opportunity, and so
we'll
put this barn up and whatever. And we really try to show everything. Just as it is every day on a farm like ours, or even any kind of farm, dairy farm, and so if we have to pull a calf or a calf needs assistance, unless it's really something dramatic requiring a vet intervention that our technicians can't handle, we show it, and in the process you're going to have X number of stillbirths. That's part of nature, and you know, because we're not doing any fetal monitoring, anything, you know, that's going to occur. And we really have not had a negative reaction to that. People understand the cycle of life and understand that this is a component of it, and, you know, it just goes with it.
Because what are some of the other complications that exist managing such a large operation?
Well, you know, obviously in today's times, I mentioned one is the manure. That's a big challenge when the environment is such an important issue, as it should be. And so one of the challenges to large farms, even small farms, depending on where they're located, is how do you manage your manure? In the 80s, there weren't many rules. In the 90s, there's a whole lot of rules, and there's going to continue to be, as there should be. And so that's probably one of our biggest challenges. And then whenever you have that many cows in proximity, you have to watch health issues and manage flies and all the stuff that go with it. And so it's just a part of our world.
Well, Gary, are the original owners of 10 people that got together, five families, were they pretty much hands-on farmers?
And absolutely.
They're still hands-on?
Continue to be today.
They're out there?
Yep, they're here. They're on the farms every day.
Yeah.
They and their kids.
And is there any kind of tax advantage to your size of any kind? Is it like the corporate farming people?
Oh, sometimes, you know, if you go into a new area, you can negotiate with either the counties or the states to try to get some breaks, but beyond that, there's not.
Right. And I'm a little sketchy on the stats here, but when I was a kid, we were getting like $12 to $14 a 100 pounds. It's not a lot more now, is it?
Not a lot more now.
How much is it now? Over 50 years ago, it was $12 to $14 a 100. Now what is it, roughly?
In that same area.
So it's still, volume is everything.
Yep.
Is milk consumption up or down?
You know, milk consumption, it depends on the category.
Okay.
If you look at fluid milk consumption, it has come down over time across the United States. Every man, woman, and child, I think, drinks roughly a little over 200 pounds of milk a year. If you divide that by 8.6, it'll tell you the gallons. It's about 11% of the beverage category, and so it's come down some over the last few decades,
but
we've kind of stabilized it. If you look at cheese... Cheese is really elevated over the last two or three decades, so the per capita consumption of cheese is doubled and tripled depending on the category. So
wine has a lot to do with that, right?
Yeah.
We're not in that one yet.
Okay.
Because you all manufacture your own cheese there too, don't you?
Yes, we do. Yeah. We have gotten into some of the value-added side, so we do some of our own manufacturing.
Right.
Doesn't take a large percent of our milk, but we do manufacture some specialty cheeses. We've been very fortunate. We've won the world championship a couple of times, and we've won the U.S. championship a couple of times. So we've had some really good results with our cheese. We are also in bottled milk. Under our label, Fair Oaks Farms, and we're probably in 350 stores in the Chicagoland and the Indianapolis market.
Wow. Well, Gary, thanks a lot. It's been interesting, and it is a fascinating place to visit. I recommend it to people who want to see where milk comes from.
Absolutely. It's not it's not that far a drive from Kentucky, just up I-65.
Yeah, about three, four
we'd love
hours.
To see you here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
You bet. Have a good day.
Gary Corbett is CEO of Fair Oaks Farms, a combine of 10 northern Indiana farms that milk almost 32,000 cows a day. For more information on Fair Oaks, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up, we head out to Swallow Rail, my farm, to do our annual summer canning show. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
Once again, we're in Chez Wishy, the finest gourmet restaurant in Shelbyville, Kentucky.
Simpsonville,
Kentucky. I irritated half of Simpsonville with that
right.
one already. Happens to be the kitchen of Miss Janine Wishy also. We're going to discuss at length, and I'm going to watch her actually deal with a new method of preserving, not new, actually it's an old and ancient
new
method
old.
Of preserving food, and she's going to explain it. We're going to begin with a zucchini. So, Miss Wishy, take over here.
Okay, so a couple years ago, I got this fabulous book for Christmas from my husband.
Preserving food without freezing or canning.
Right.
Wow.
But using what? Lactic fermentation, oil,
salt,
drying,
oil, sugar,
salt.
Alcohol. I like that part.
Yeah.
Vinegar drying, cold storage, and lactic fermentation.
Lactic fermentation. Yeah. So lactic fermentation, basically, everybody's familiar with sauerkraut, but it's how you make sauerkraut. So I got interested in sort of these old-fashioned methods of preserving food. You know, the freezer in and of itself changed the way we could store food. It was revolutionary, right?
Yeah.
Heat sterilization, that sort of thing as well, pressure canning, all very good. But I wanted to, you know me.
Yes, I do.
I wanted to know some of the old ways. I mean, how did people survive thousands and hundreds of thousands of years without electricity and freezers? So these two, last year I tried it, different methods, but I was pretty conservative with the amounts that I did.
Right.
Because I wanted to make sure, you know, it actually worked and I felt comfortable with it. So the two that were total hits last year for me was the preserving zucchini in oil. And then salt brine green beans. And the value of it is that you preserve more nutrients and flavor of the vegetable as well.
Now, what kind of oil are you using here?
I'm using, okay, first we'll go ahead and start, Bob. The first
should,
one that
should
we're going to
do. Read the recipe or
why don't you read the recipe?
Okay.
But it's a basically like poached zucchini in oil. So
I think it's my first ever recipe reading. I'm excited.
All right.
The ingredients include zucchini, vinegar, mint leaves, oil, a saucepan, canning jars and lids, and Bob Hill. The directions. Choose small, firm zucchini. Wash and cut them in half or in several pieces if they are large. Heat enough vinegar in a saucepan to cover the zucchini. Immerse the zucchini in the vinegar as soon as it begins to boil. Immediately remove the heat and leave the zucchini to poach for 5 minutes. I love that word, poach.
Yeah.
Drain and blot with paper towels, like as if they were bleeding. Layer the zucchini in the jars along with two or three chopped mint leaves. Cover the contents of the jar with oil. That would be, what kind of oil again?
I use olive oil.
Olive oil, and close it, preferably with a cork. The zucchini will keep for up to 3,000 years in a dry, cool place. No, actually, it's up to 1 year, in a dry, cool place.
Right. Okay.
This is fun.
So what I've done here is I've got these like wide mouth, like half quart jars. Is that what those are? And they're wide mouth because they're just easier to work with. What I've done is we brought a pot of vinegar to a boil. And it's no longer boiling, so we put the zucchini in.
Okay.
And then we're going to push the timer for 5 minutes.
She's multitasking. She pushed a timer and stirred her zucchini at the same time.
because the poaching, basically in the vinegar, I mean, everybody knows that vinegar is acid.
Yeah.
So vinegar is going to, you know, help in that preservation because it's, so instead, you know, they're not going to be pickled as such, but that vinegar penetrating the zucchini will help in the preservation, be too acidic for any bacteria to grow. That's the whole point. I mean, you know, you can get scientific about it, but that's the general sort of scenario.
And what does the oil do then?
So then the oil, once we take these off and drain them, we're going to pack them into the jars.
Okay.
And then we're going to fill, you know, and I try to pack them pretty tightly. And I'm put, okay. I've got some mint leaves here too, Bob, that I'll put in there with them.
Wow.
And then we'll pour the oil in. And the oil, what does oil do?
Well, it lubes my engines.
Yeah. It prevents oxygen, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So the oxygen is what will allow certain bacteria and spoilage agents grow. So if you prevent oxygen, you're going to prevent, you know, the decomposition of the vegetable for one, but also the ability to acid because of the vinegar, and then no and the oxygen because of the oil.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, could you eat these in either 5 minutes or 5 months, and they taste the same, basically? Or would they age a little bit?
They would probably age a little bit, I would think. I didn't eat ours until, because the whole point is to preserve it for later when I don't have fresh. So last year, I ate probably sometime in January or February. And what I did, you know, the question is, how do you use them? And talking about salt and oil, using salt and oil, and if it's good for you or not.
Right.
But the amount of oil that's in there isn't so much. And basically, I would just do like a pasta dish. So I'd boil some pasta and then saute. I'd use the oil from my preserved zucchini to saute some onions and maybe some other vegetables.
Oh.
Then you put your zucchini in, heat it through, and then you toss it with your pasta. And you've got a little bit of that vinegar taste to it, right?
Yep.
And the oil already that you would be using if you were going to make a pasta dish.
No wasted ingredients.
No. And it was fabulous.
The vinegar, the oil, the zucchini are all used up.
Right. And the texture of the zucchini and the taste of the zucchini was far superior than any other kind of frozen zucchini I've ever done, you know? So I'm really kind of sold on this particular method. Okay, another note. Before you all came, I did sterilize all of my jars in my big water bath canning thing that you and Janet bought me a couple of years ago when you were down in like Alabama or something.
Yep.
So it gets lots of use. So they were sterilized in simmering water for 10 minutes, as well as the lids. So I know I have sterile, clean jars to work with, so I shouldn't have any problems. Spoilage, usually the average spoilage is pretty apparent. Botulism isn't, is the thing.
Good point,
I mean, and I think that's why the USDA and the FDA, you know, are hardcore about recommending, like they would recommend, they would not endorse me saying, don't do a hot water bath, although I'm not going to, because I trust the reasonable safety of this,
living
right?
on the edge with zucchini. Yeah,
it's not, though. You know what I mean?
Right.
But they're in the business of protecting the consumer and also mass production of food. But the tricky thing about botulism is that it's not detectable. And, you know, it's lethal, too. But it also doesn't just pop up anywhere spontaneously like, you know, other types of spoilage
Got two liquid questions for you.
Sure.
One, is it white or cider vinegar?
I'm using cider vinegar, but you can also use white vinegar if you'd like.
Okay, and then you say you use olive oil and not corn or vegetable oil.
That's just my choice.
But you could use corn or vegetable if you wanted to.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's our timer.
Okay.
It's going off.
Me.
So we're going to take our zucchini, our poached zucchini.
Okay. She's removing the poached zucchini from the pot.
You can see the skin's changed a little bit of a color, right?
Yeah.
A little bit of a, you know, duller color than the green.
This is homegrown zucchini, I am sure.
Yes, it was picked this morning. And I'm putting it on a towel.
And she's taking the excess vinegar off. She's blotting it very nicely.
My sterile jars.
She's got her sterile jar in the left hand. The zucchini in her right hand, they're going in the jar.
And look, I cut them right, the perfect length.
It's the moment of truth.
To fit into the jar,
three,
right?
Three, four, five.
But they literally look like dill pickle spears.
Seven.
And this, I found too, this is a perfect amount that fits in these jars.
Eight, Uh-oh, she's hammering that one in.
This is a perfect amount.
Will she get 10? Eight it is, huh?
No, I think I can fit some more.
All right, well, nine.
For a vegetable compliment for a dinner for Amy and I.
Double figures here, about to get to 10. Wow. 10 zucchini in the jar. That one's squished and squeaked a little bit.
There, I think I can fit one more.
11. It's a new Shelby County record. Nope, 12. A dozen. a baker's dozen zucchini.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
she's using her fingers here, folks. She's cheating, but she got a dozen of them in there.
That's, but the more you pack in there, the less oil.
Yeah, they look
you have
like little
use.
Soldiers standing up in the glass jar there.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe maybe a smaller one.
She's using another zucchini to stuff the other dozen.
There we go. Okay.
13, a baker's dozen.
And I'm going to stick some mint in there.
The mint's on top.
I guess we
she's
could measure
pouring
out.
In.
Measure out how much oil. In
the oil, there. She's pouring it in from a, it's like
not,
a one.
That's not an excessive amount of
a
oil.
A 2 gallon container. Nope. It's a nice light green color, kind of matches the zucchini.
And then we've got our sterile lids over here.
She's sterile lids. Oh, there it is. Now, do you have to make the lid pop again with the...
No.
You close it down, that's it.
That's it.
Honk that one more time in the microphone. I like that sound. Bump, bump. There you go.
So, yeah, you have to, I guess, just sort of trust...
Yeah.
Trust the science of it. And, you know, use your best judgment. And you can tell if it spoils, you know, any other way. But it shouldn't because of the vinegar and because of the oil.
It's a handsome-looking jar full of zucchini sticks.
And it tastes really good.
Yep.
All right, the next one, this is a fabulous, fabulous recipe.
That's why we're all here.
So turn to page, I believe it's 77.
Oh, this is a lecture. Is there going to be a pop quiz on this?
No, I want you to read, actually go back to where that copper dart is in the book. A couple pages before that.
Oh, copper dart.
So I want you to read about lactic fermentation for me.
Okay, radio listeners, we're about to talk about preserving by lactic fermentation. Preserving vegetables for months using neither heat, cold, nor preservatives, yet retaining the original freshness and nutritional value of these vegetables, this is the miracle of lactic fermentation. The process is so easy and effective that we wonder why it has nearly disappeared from use. Still used for making sauerkraut and for turnips at a few farms in Alsace and France, lactic fermentation was the primary method for preserving vegetables before heat sterilization was discovered. Let's recall how it is done. The vegetables are grated or cut up, seasoned with a bit of salt or a mild brine and herbs, and left to soak in their own juice. Salt is a key. A good rule of thumb is about 1.5% salt by weight of vegetables, which generally translates to 2 or 3 tablespoons of salt per quart. We'll deal with more of that later. Lactate microbial organisms, similar to those that curdle milk, develop spontaneously. Sort of the Big Bang, the Little Bang theory, and convert the natural sugars of the vegetable into lactic acid. This environment rapidly acidifies to the point that it becomes impossible for bacteria responsible for food spoilage to multiply. Vegetables preserved this way will keep in a cool place, such as a cellar, for many months. This process is remarkable in its simplicity, effectiveness, and beneficial effects on nutritional value and digestibility. There you go.
Very good. So what we're going to do here, Bob, is that this is now page 77.
Page 77. The, it's my lucky number, so that's supposed to happen that way.
Salt, brine, green beans. Okay. So these were freshly picked. They're clean. Actually, the recommendation is not to wash them.
Uh-oh.
You know, unless they've got dirt on them, but they don't have dirt on them. So
why wouldn't
you
wash them?
Basically, the recommendation of not washing vegetables, you remove some quality that takes away their ability to, you know, remain more fresh, basically.
Okay. So you're now stuffing some beans into a jar.
You want to read the recipe, which
is
super simple?
Make a brine of 2 tablespoons of salt per quart of water. Bring to a boil and let cool. Remove the strings from the freshly picked beans and fill the jars, packing the beans just slightly. Do not wash the beans unless they are very dirty. Pour the cooled brine over the beans right up to the top of the jars. Close the jars with a rubber seal lid and store them in the cellar. It is preferable to soak the beans in water overnight to remove the salt before cooking them.
Right.
You did that.
I did that last year. Okay. So at this point we have our water.
We have the water.
And our a quart of water and our 2 tablespoons of salt.
Yep.
I'm using caning salt.
And we'll talk about salt a little later because that's a lot of salt, but later on in the process, you remove the salt so people aren't ingesting quite as much salt, right?
Exactly. And we're going to salt our food, you know, homegrown food. We right. salt it ourselves so we can control it as opposed yeah. to processed food. But salt's a great, you know, preservative. But last year I did this, and I, in fact, at U of L with my food and body politic class, I fed my students.
Ah.
They trusted me, and they loved the green beans. I think it was our study session day in class at the very end. Wow. I cooked for them. I took my grandmother's old electric skillet,
oh, no.
plugged it in. And basically the concept was cost and taste and time and that sort of thing.
Right.
So I had all the stuff that you needed to make French's onion green bean casserole, yep. right? And had priced all that out. I'm like, okay, would you rather have this? Or would wow. you rather have this? So I had my salt brine green beans, my fresh green beans, soaked, but, you know, mushrooms that were dry. And I made a green bean, you know, salad for
wow.
them.
How many students?
And they loved it. I think like 35.
You fed them all?
Yeah. Like everybody got a little bit.
Everybody got an A in the cars, too?
No, but most people did really well.
Are you going to go face down on the desk?
No, exactly. I tasted them the night before. So fresh like that, they taste like they're maybe slightly pickled, but not pickled.
I've been there.
They have a crunch like that they were just picked out of the garden.
Yep.
Far superior, again, to a frozen green bean or a pressure canned green bean.
You finish the process here now? You're going to...
Yeah, okay, so finish the process. We've packed our jar... it's a wide mouth jar again because it's much easier to use.
Well, it's a big one. It's like uh-huh. a full
this is a bigger one,
quart.
And it's full of fine green beans.
Yep.
And the brine will cool to right. you know just room temperature. We will pour the
Dump
brine
in
into the jar, and we will seal it, and that is it.
Then when you take them out, you'll wash the
right when
wash
I them. When I'm ready to use them,
to
I'll dump the
out.
Water out, yeah. and then I'll fill the jar back up with just fresh water.
Right.
Let them soak overnight in the refrigerator.
There you go.
And then they're ready to go.
Okay.
You can either eat them, you know, fresh, cold, like in a salad, tossed in a salad kind of thing, or heat them through in any dish, plain mixture, whatever. It's just amazing. So
all right.
I just encourage people to try some kind of old-fashioned methods. And do check out Preserving Food Without Freezing or Canning, traditional techniques using salt, oil, sugar, alcohol, vinegar, drying, cold storage, and lactic fermentation. It's the Gardeners and Farmers of Terre Vivante.
I cannot wait to taste them.
Yeah, it's a book is published by Chelsea Green. All right.
Good work, Miss Wishy.
Thanks for coming out.
For more information on Miss Wishy's preserver methods or to see pictures of the process, go to the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Still Bob Hill.
I haven't poisoned you with anything.
Still doing bad poetry until the bitter end.
Till the bitter end.
Or not so bitter end, we hope.
Yeah, we're not bitter.
Not at all.
But we had mentioned earlier in the show that this is the last Homegrown, hopefully just for a while.
Right.
We really, and the station does as well, we want to try to come back, and we want to definitely try to come back seasonally and do some shows from time to time. But the state of the economy right now has forced them to make some tough decisions.
Yep.
So Homegrown's being pulled for now.
And they were totally honest about it, which I appreciate that.
You know, we do.
When all else fails, tell me the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be the truth.
That's right.
It is an economic deal. And we love doing the show. We love public radio. We don't want to, you know, in any way injure public radio. We feel as bad as the listeners, we hope.
Yeah.
We didn't want this. We didn't
right.
expect this, but that's the
yeah.
way things are, and we're all big kids here.
It's 9 years, Bob.
Yeah.
9 years we've been doing
and
it.
No spelling. I loved it.
Yeah. That's right. You had
no
you
spelling.
Did have an editor to a certain degree, but not in
yeah.
your spelling,
just
right?
You.
and Brad.
Yeah.
You don't hear Brad's voice
no.
much, but you hear his name, and he is just a huge part of this show.
Yeah.
The uncut version of Homegrown isn't nearly as good
no.
After Brad's had a chance to edit us a little bit. So
Brad
Yost, yes. Yeah. Produced by Brad Yost. And we appreciate that and hope to be with Brad again. But, what's the most profound thing I think maybe that you'll be able to take away from all of this?
I think we set out from day one to be an eclectic show, to not just be gardening, but to include the environment, and we do. We talk to people all over the country and around the world. One thing I think about continually as a result of this show is the symbiotic relationships in nature,
mm-hmm.
plants and animals and the sky and the water, and how it's all so related. And I think we worked very hard to make that clear to people that if you lose one, you're going to lose the other.
That's right.
We're all in this together.
Just to like open your eyes and be enchanted by everything and not want to kill everything or not
right.
want to, or not think that everything has to be perfect,
yeah.
I think is something that over the years people have picked up on, you know, in these different
yeah.
little, not necessarily cohesive.
We've also had free rein here, which has been nice. Mm-hmm. I always appreciate that. They let us do our show the way we wanted to do it. Much to their regret, probably on occasion, or ours.
I don't think we got in trouble too many times.
No, but I really, you know, I like working for people that care about quality product, and I think we did.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of the finances at this point.
That's right.
And you can help us out here, folks.
You can.
We don't want to go away.
We don't want to go away. No. But yeah, we will try to come back from time to time if the finances allow. But we have so enjoyed doing this job.
Yeah.
We've met so many great people along the way.
Oh, boy.
Learned so many things along the way, and we hope that you have as well. We do hope that you'll continue to support your local businesses.
And public radio.
And yeah, I mean, yeah. Enjoy gardening, and don't let any failure disappoint you or deter you, because
right.
really that's the best way to learn. We will keep in touch somehow through the website. You can go to wfpl.org. We're going to pick out some favorite interviews from over the years and, you know, mix them up from time to time and have them posted on the website. And of course, our shows are archived, not all 9 years, but up to
right.
a certain point. So you can go back and listen to past shows as well until we can maybe claw our way back to the airways.
Peeking over the transom.
That's right. That's right. But Bob and I will continue to do what we do and what we love. We just won't be able to talk about it with you over the airwaves.
But so we're going to love you anyway.
We will. And one of the things you're so good at, Bob, is putting pen to paper.
Oh, my God.
And crafting crazy little stories and plant poems and such. And today is the last day. Happens to be
the rest
a Bob plant story day.
Okay.
So what do you have for us? Let's end it on a happy note.
One word.
With a bang.
You ready?
I'm ready.
Neem.
Oh, no, you're kidding.
No.
Good for you.
I'm doing neem.
That's fabulous.
Yeah, we talked about neem all the time.
So appropriate.
Yeah, that's fun. We've talked about it and joked about it. Neem, of course, is an organic pesticide and fungicide. It's also a tree. How
mm-hmm.
did I not know this?
Yep.
Called the neem tree. And it's Latin, and I'm guessing here because this is a tough one. The Latin name for the neem tree is Azadirachta indica. Azadirachta indica.
Because it's in India. India.
Okay, I'm sticking with that until proven wrong.
Okay.
It is a native of India and Burma. And for thousands of years, its leaves have been used as repellent for gnats and mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
The active ingredient in this is an oil, something called azadiroctin. And it's offered in modern medicine as a spiritual thing, and there's a lot of different uses for it. But it's also used as a pesticide and a fungicide. And there was a long article in the latest Horticulture magazine by a man named Peter Garnham, who's got an organic farm and understands these things. And he explained much better than I can the good and the bad of neem. And let me just read some of that, and then I'll finish up with my usual fabulous poem. And I didn't know this. It said, neem deters insects from feeding and interferes with their normal life cycle. It disrupts their hormonal balance so that they die before they molt to the next stage of life.
Okay.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a contact poison. It has to be consumed by insects.
So systemic.
Yeah, it makes it effective against pests that eat plants, but safe for beneficial insects do not.
Okay.
However, it can still cause problems with honeybees and other things.
Sure.
It's effective against aphids, armyworms, beetles, cabbage worms, caterpillars, fungus gnats, Japanese beetles, all those kinds of things. It acts like a fungicide, too, controlling black spot. The bottom line is, while you wouldn't mind doing without Japanese beetles, Colorado potato beetles, flea beetles, etc., think about the hundreds of beetles that do tremendously valuable work in our gardens,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
creating mulch.
Sure.
Or the caterpillars that chomp on leaves and turn into butterflies.
Yeah.
So you're killing them.
Right. You don't, but we've always been, don't broadcast anything, you know,
right.
indiscriminately.
It's exactly.
For sketchy situations.
But it goes to that dynamic of the
mm-hmm.
good and the bad.
Absolutely.
Which brings Bob to his final poem.
All right.
We hope not. How to deal with the dilemma of going green with a feel-good product. Let's call it neem. Derived from the oil of a so-named tree, which may be quite safe for you and me. But what of the caterpillar? Must it too die before becoming a butterfly? Or the beetles who turn our mulch to soil? Should they too perish from foreign oil? Oh, what tangled webs we weave when dealing with the neem tree leaves. How sad a song we all can sing by merely trying to do the right thing.
Very good. That ends our last edition of Homegrown. For a while, perhaps, we will be back from time to time to bring you something seasonal. We've loved every minute of it. Thank you.
Homegrown is produced by the never poisonous Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill, and always will be.
And I'm Janine Wishy.